our first founding document says, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Very important concept. They didn't say we hold this ideology, we hold this philosophy, we hold this political platform. These were people trying to get at what they thought was the truth about human nature, the truth about whether or not you have rights. And what did they say those truths were? First, that we're all created equal. And they meant equality before the law, not equality of outcome, but equality of opportunity. They said, second, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, why does that matter? You, as a citizen, are sovereign. You loan power to the government. The government does not loan power to you. And that's why the Constitution begins, we the people of the United States. Doesn't begin, we the lawyers, we the judges, we the bureaucrats, we the politicians, we the people. Now, you might ask, so what does this historic backdrop mean for the Second Amendment and for the right to bear arms? I would argue it means everything. Notice they said these rights are unalienable. Now, when you get to the Bill of Rights, the Second Amendment begins in a very interesting way. It talks about the inherent right to bear arms. It doesn't say the Constitution gives you the right. It says the right to bear arms will not be abridged, which implies that the Founding Fathers who wrote the Constitution believed that your right to bear arms came from your Creator and was unalienable. It did not come from the government. Now, you might say, why did they think this? And I want to recommend to you, it's a fascinating story in history. If you go back and you look at 236 years ago this month, the British Army set out from Boston to crush the rebellion. Tension had been building for a number of years, and the Americans were being very uppity. And the British Empire was the richest, most powerful empire in the world. And David Hackett Fisher wrote a tremendous book called Paul Revere's Ride, in which Fisher's a great historian. And he describes the setting that led to Paul Revere's Ride and what happened after he rode out to warn the colonists. And he points out in his book that the British Army knew how to crush peasant rebellions. They'd crushed rebellions in Ireland, they'd crushed rebellions in Scotland, they'd crushed rebellions in Wales, they'd crushed rebellions in rural England. And so the professional soldiers who were marching out that day, they knew what they were doing. They were going to encounter a bunch of rabble, they were going to scatter them, they were going to seize their weapons, they were going to imprison their leaders, and it would all be over. And then they ran into this problem. They didn't have any peasants to fight, and they didn't have any rabble to fight. They had freestanding Americans who had been training as a militia and who were prepared to fight the British Army toe-to-toe. And by the end of the day, the British Army was running back to Boston, suffering substantial casualties, and in a state of shock. Now, the Founding Fathers knew this history. They had lived this history. And they knew that if they had not had the right to bear arms, they would have been crushed that day. They then engage, they issue a Declaration of Independence. And on July 9th, 1776, General George Washington, on Bowling Green in Manhattan, has it read to the Continental Army. And that Declaration of Independence defies the most powerful empire in the world and asserts the rights I just described to you. Now, this is an army that is going to get beaten very badly. It gets beaten in September in Brooklyn. It gets beaten in Manhattan. It gets beaten at White Plains. It gets beaten at the Palisades. It gets driven across New Jersey. By December of 1776, 6 months, 5 months after the declaration is announced, all these happy-go-lucky people who thought it was going to be easy were gone, and they were down. They shrank from 30,000 to 2,500 men. Those 2,500 men were on the edge of collapse. And Washington proposed the most daring possible strategy. He said, why don't we cross the river in the ice during a snowstorm at night, march 9 miles, surprise a professional German unit, defeat them decisively, and reestablish the morale of the revolution. Every single one of his generals said to him, this is too hard. We can't do this. And Washington, who had been fighting as early as 18 or 19 years of age and was very seasoned and had been through some very dangerous moments, had once had two horses shot out from under him and four bullet holes in his coat during the French and Indian Wars in one day. Washington said to them, well, you know, if we don't win someplace, this army's going to desert. When the army deserts in another week or two, we will have lost the war. When we lose the war, everybody in this room is going to be hung. So we have nothing to lose. It's a little bit like the New Hampshire slogan, live free or die. I always remind people, it's not live free or whimper. Live free or hire a lobbyist. So that night, they crossed the river. Now, Washington was a very, very shrewd person. He knew that people are moved as much by words as they are by deeds. And so he had recruited Thomas Paine, who had written a great pamphlet, Common Sense, which was the best explanation of the Declaration of Independence and which had been very widely read in the colonies. And he recruited Paine, and Paine wrote a pamphlet called The Crisis, which begins, these are the times that try men's souls. And in fact, last year, Bill Fortune and I wrote a novel called To Try Men's Souls, which is about this crossing. So as the troops are getting on the ship that night, and they're going over in rowboats, Washington has the officers reading the opening chapter that talks about summer soldiers will have deserted, but that if you stand firm, all eternity will owe you gratitude for having stood up for freedom. So here's this hardy band of 2,500. One third of them do not have boots. They're marching with their feet wrapped in burlap in the ice and snow and leaving a trail of blood. They cross the river at night. They then discover to their surprise they have to cross two ravines. We have to take the cannon down one side, up the other side, in the ice during a snowstorm. And they're running 4 hours late, 4 hours late. If you war game this, you play it out as a board game at home, the Americans get annihilated because they arrive after dawn and the professional German soldiers kill them. However, there was one other factor. They're being pushed forward by an enormous wind coming out of the north with an enormous snowstorm. And so they're marching south. And the professional German soldiers conclude that no European army could be out in this kind of weather. And so they don't post their guards. And it's not that they're sloppy, it's not that they're stupid. They made a totally reasonable calculation if they were fighting Europeans. Now, they forgot that in America, many of you who are deer hunters will understand this, Americans often go hunting in the weirdest possible weather. So for all these American soldiers, this was kind of like normal. It was cold, it was miserable, but it was normal. They surprise the Germans. At the cost of one American, they capture 800 professional soldiers. They run like crazy for the river to get across again before the British Army can catch them. They've won a great victory. Within 2 weeks, 15,000 volunteers show up. Washington takes the new forces, drives the British out of northern New Jersey, and the Revolutionary War has been saved. Now, it doesn't end. Washington is in the field. I want you to remember this when you're campaigning next year and you get tired and you start saying, oh, gee, this is too hard. Washington was in the field for 8 years. He spent 1 week at Mount Vernon in 8 years. That was the price of the freedom you have. That night, because they really were down to the end, the password that night was victory or death, and they meant it. Now, these are the people who wrote in the right to bear arms. And I just want to say, and I don't want to offend anybody here who's a hunter, the right to bear arms is not about hunting. It's not about target practice. The right to bear arms is a political right designed to safeguard freedom so that no government can take away from you the rights which God has given you. And it was written by people who had spent their lifetime fighting the greatest empire in the world. And they knew that if they had not had the right to bear arms, they would have been enslaved. And they did not want us to be enslaved. And that is why they guaranteed us the right to protect ourselves. It is a political right of the deepest importance to the survival of freedom in America.
Revolution, that period of time when we became a country, but you're a little fuzzy on the details. What do we know for certain? We became a country and became independent in July of 1776. And because of that, you all get a day off to eat hamburgers and watch fireworks. Hooray! Most people don't stop to ask why the founders decided to declare independence from a powerful empire, considering the big risks associated with that action. In the next few videos, I'll try and give you a sense of why the founders thought they should do this. My name's Sarah Burns, and I'm a professor of political science. I study the American Constitution as well as the ideological origins of the Revolution. I've always found this period so interesting because it's a group of people coming together and creating a country. To quote Hamilton, they decided to create a country from reflection and choice rather than accident and force. Just like that. Moreover, they actually managed to create a dialogue amongst a diverse group of people under incredibly stressful circumstances. So what were the stressors? First, they were trying to create a democracy over a large area. States of that size, at the time, were always run by monarchs. No one really thought that you could have a democracy over a country this size. Second, they were going up against the British military, which was a formidable fighting force, and we were not a formidable fighting force. What we see in the Revolution, therefore, is a powerful testament to what people can achieve if they devote themselves to an important cause and work together. So, without further ado, in the following videos, we'll look at the lead-up to the American Revolution. We'll talk about the increasing tensions between the British and the colonists, especially the abuses of the armed forces and the increase in taxes. Then we'll look at the ideological underpinnings of the Revolution. And finally, we'll look at what the Declaration declares. Leading up to the Revolution, the colonists had two major types of grievances. First was the changing role of the British soldiers, and the second was the increase in taxes. In this first video, we'll look at the changing role of those soldiers. In 1763, the British and the French had just finished up fighting a war called, unimaginatively, the Seven Years' War. The North American theater of that war was called the French and Indian War, and it had a dramatic impact on life under British rule. After the war, the military's role started shifting. The king asked the military to enforce increasingly painful measures, which made them seem much more like an occupying force than a source of security. So how did this come to pass? At the end of the Seven Years' War, the British had a huge military without a huge international war to fight. Now you might be thinking, why not draw down forces? Spend your money on something else. If you are thinking that, you're not thinking like a king. By the mid-18th century, the king had deployed the military in a number of wars internationally, causing them to triple in size. By this point, they're organizationally very sophisticated, and more importantly, the king intended to make them permanent. Now, what do you do if you have a big army and a big navy and they don't have a big war to fight? You send them to the colonies. Now, initially, the king had a point. The colonists kept pushing into native land reserved to them by treaty, and every time the British would say, "Can you please stop doing that?" the colonists just ignored them. This worked out perfectly for the English because they needed something for their army to do. And that's thinking like a king. Find a problem for the military to solve rather than drawing down forces. But they didn't stop there. after 1763, the English started to ask the military to collect taxes and control Americans. It's this shift that started angering colonists and marks a change in the relationship. It's important to see that the British and the Americans saw things very differently. While the armed forces started to irritate the Americans, politicians back home didn't back down. In fact, they doubled down. The British saw them as a source of revenue, and so therefore didn't take colonial concerns very seriously. They claimed that the army was actually protecting Americans rather than oppressing them. This was not the right reaction. As time progressed, the English started to use the military more and more to enforce law as Parliament saw fit. Turning the screws like this only served to increase tension. Shockingly, the colonists started fighting back. There was a ratcheting effect as the relationship between colonists and soldiers deteriorated. There were skirmishes, one of which ended in the death of a colonist in New York. There was a general sense of ill will as soldiers would get drunk and harass local women. There were patriots who would tar and feather anyone deemed too loyal to the king. Needless to say, tensions mounted. And then came the Boston Massacre in 1770. British customs agents asked the military to help enforce new duties imposed on imports, and they did so with weapons, which is always good when you're trying to keep things light and breezy. Locals would then taunt the soldiers to shoot at them, and when one did, either by accident or on purpose, depending on who you ask, it ended in the Boston Massacre, which resulted in the death of 5 colonists. This event ended up symbolizing British oppression in the mind of the colonists as news of the event spread throughout America. We see here that the British and the colonists viewed events remarkably differently. While the English thought they would eventually settle down, each abuse, each effort to keep them under the imperial thumb, only served to push Americans towards declaring independence. And the military is far from the only problem. In the next video, we'll look at how the English increased taxes in order to pay for all of these bad decisions. Let's talk about the most exciting part of any revolution, taxes! Hear me out. As you may remember from school, the colonists got very upset about the new taxes imposed by the British. Now you might be thinking, well, everyone gets upset when new taxes are imposed. What's important to see here is the context. That will help us understand why it is that the founders reacted so dramatically that they decided to commit treason against the crown. Since the British continued to have a large military at the end of the French and Indian War, they needed a way to pay for it. And how do governments pay for things? Taxes! That's right. The British were taxing the Americans so that they could pay for the soldiers who were then harassing those very same Americans. Colonists got angry. When Parliament passed the Tea Act of 1773, Bostonians took a bunch of that tea and dumped it into the harbor in protest of this new tax. Now you might be thinking, why didn't the British just pull back when they saw how angry this was all making the colonists? Once again, if you thought that, you would not be thinking like an imperial power. Rebellions, after all, aren't indulged, they're quashed. The English doubled down, passing more and more restrictive measures on the colonists. They closed the Boston port and established parliamentary supremacy in that city, as well as punishing Bostonians for their actions. By 1774, they had passed 2 more of the 5 intolerable acts. Why did this bother Americans so much? It bothered them because it was parliamentary meddling and a steady encroachment on their freedoms. That's why they decided to fight back and fight back so hard. After all, they thought that life would return to normal after the French and Indian War. So what was life like before the war? There was limited English oversight on colonial affairs. They mostly governed themselves. There was no direct taxation from Parliament. Colonists could participate fairly well in legislative affairs domestically, and there was a fairly free trade system. There were customs agents and a quasi-mercantilist system, but they were fairly corrupt, so as long as you bribed them, you could pretty much import and export what you wanted to. After the war, however, England expected the colonists to pay for the privilege of remaining in the British Empire. Mostly because they needed the money. By the end of the war, they were £130 million in debt, which is a huge amount of money at the time. So politicians did what politicians do when they need to pay the bills. They raised taxes. And at first, colonists used the political process to seek redress. They would petition Parliament and tell them how negatively the new taxes impacted the colonies, or find parliamentarians who were sympathetic to their cause. In the Stamp Act of 1765, however, Parliament announced it had the power to directly tax the colonists. And it's this novel power that caused significant concern. By the Tea Act of 1773, they realized they'd reached a point of no return. And this is partially what led to the Boston Tea Party. Bostonians especially saw that something important had changed. Now, this isn't about tea in particular, or taxes, per se. It's about power. Parliament had asserted novel powers and established a pattern of encroaching on freedom. By the 1770s, colonists see that this isn't a way to pay down the war debt. Parliament wants more power permanently. And this isn't something that Americans can accept. We see here that while the military provides a good visual understanding of the oppression, the new taxes cause just as much ire. The British made the Americans feel as if the military was a threat rather than a source of security. And now, they're making them feel as if the political process, meant to ensure their liberty, was actually a way to oppress them. To better understand why the colonists perceived this change so radically, it's important to look at the ideology behind the rebellion. That will make it clearer why it is that revolution eventually became necessary. Stay tuned! Let's start with that familiar phrase, no taxation without representation. What does this phrase mean, and why is it important? Much like us today, colonists thought of themselves as a free people. When governments assert novel powers, this makes a free people nervous. The colonists saw the encroachment of Parliament through the prism of something called radical Whig theory. Because of this theory, the events after 1763 took on a certain meaning that eventually compelled rebellion. Now, first things first, what is radical Whig theory? And no, it has nothing to do with actual Whigs. Whig theory started in England years earlier as a response to the increasing power of the king and the court. Yes, they worried about it too. This theory holds that individuals within a free society must jealously guard their liberty and be wary of any government encroachment. This school of thought focuses on reviving ancient ideals of civic virtue. It holds that freedom is hard to keep and easy to lose. For that reason, when government starts encroaching, it's incumbent on a people to fight back. If they don't fight back, they have to consider themselves too morally corrupt for self-governance. Americans didn't think that Parliament had the power to directly tax them. Free men, after all, only answer to themselves, and Americans didn't have a representative in Parliament. Without a representative, therefore, there's only so much power a distant government can assert before it starts to look oppressive. By the time Parliament started passing the Intolerable Acts in the 1770s, colonists realized they had to resist, collectively. This led to the creation of the Continental Congress, where they tried to determine how to resist these novel powers. Meanwhile, in England, they continued to have a tin ear to colonial grievances. They didn't want to give up their power to tax, so instead, they declared the colonies in rebellion and passed several measures trying to quash it. This went against England's ultimate interest and demonstrates how differently each side saw the argument. While Parliament wished to bring the colonists to heel, it's possible, or even likely, that if they had had a lighter touch, colonists would have relented. After all, what they were looking for was a representative in Parliament and a few other things. So it was the obstinance and the arrogance of the English that pushed several who were on the fence over toward the side of revolution. It pushed them over because of Whig ideology. The concerns in the Continental Congress stem from the view that powerful government is a very serious threat to political liberty. This is true at both the top and the bottom. At the top, power can collect into one set of hands. At the bottom, individuals who are too weak to push back against government encroachment are viewed as morally corrupt. In the colonies, therefore, accepting the increased presence of the armed forces and accepting the increased burden of the new taxes would demonstrate a lack of political virtue. Because of this, the post-war events convinced even those who were hesitant that they had to rebel, and this would eventually lead to war with England. Whig theory is one of two important ideologies underlying the revolutionary spirit. The other is classical liberalism, as exemplified by John Locke. In the next video, we'll look through how it is that his theory influenced the founders and how they weaved these two theories together to create a new democratic order. We're at a breaking point. It's 1776, and the colonists have tried repeatedly to reconcile with England. They realize now they have to declare independence and start the uphill battle to fight for their freedom. Once they made that decision, they felt compelled to explain why it is that their relationship with England suffered from irreconcilable differences. And that's how we got the Declaration of Independence. This document was tricky to write for a couple of reasons. First, they had been claiming their rights as Englishmen. Once you separate from England, can't do that anymore. Second, this puts into writing that they're rebelling against the king. And rebelling against the king is no joke. If you lose, you hang. Don't pass go, don't collect $200, just straight to jail, and then the hangman's block. What's their argument in the Declaration of Independence? They're claiming that we, as a free people, have a right to stand up to an oppressor. Now today, this seems perfectly understandable. Only a government established by the people, that protects the rights of the people, deserves their support, right? Well, at the time, this was a very radical idea. No one had tried to claim this as a reason to rebel. This concept was radical, new, and based in philosophy. Specifically, the philosophy of John Locke, who created a theory about why people can declare independence from an oppressive government. This is another important philosophical strain that underlies the revolution. It combines with radical Whig theory to create a good foundation for a new constitutional order. While radical Whig theory emphasizes civic virtue and a wariness of government power, Lockean liberalism emphasizes rights protection and the responsibility of government. Locke develops this theory by looking at the origin of government. According to him, human beings start out in an ahistorical state of nature. In that state, they are all free and equal. There's a problem, though. We're all selfish and irrational. There is no objective party to mediate disputes. For him, therefore, it's necessary for us to come into society and create a government. In order to do this, it has to be possible for a people to rebel if the government isn't protecting their rights. So, if the leader of a government doesn't protect your rights, off with his head. Just kidding. But it is appropriate, according to Lockean theory, for a people to overthrow their government if they fail in this crucial respect. Locke claims there's no difference between an unjust king and a thief. Therefore, in the same way that we can stop a thief, we can overthrow a king. It's through a Lockean understanding of government by consent that we can move from seeing ourselves as British citizens, seeking the justice of the crown, to human beings born free and equal, confronting an oppressive ruler. We see these ideas reflected in the Declaration of Independence. England had regularly violated their rights. To that end, in the declaration, there's 27 indictments against the king. This looks a lot like a list of indictments against a criminal. Let's look at an example. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He sounds like a mob boss. Because of his actions, we were free to dissolve our allegiance to him and form a new society based on the consent of the governed. And we see this in the Declaration's preamble. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. It's important to see how radical this was for the time. Monarchs ran states of our size, and the leader was considered sovereign. We completely flipped that around. We said the people were the sovereign power, very shocking, and said that the government was answerable to the people, even more shocking. Now you might be thinking, that's the end of the story. We've declared independence, and now we live happily ever after as a new country. Right? Wrong. This is where the real work begins. Now we have to create new institutions based on radical philosophy. We have to get a diverse group of people to agree, and then we have to get people to accept these new institutions. This is no easy task, as we'll see in the concluding video. It's July, 1776. We're a small but scrappy colony of a large empire. We've just declared our independence and committed treason. We don't have a large military force. We aren't set up to fight a multi-front war. And we're trying to create new institutions based on radical ideas created by philosophers. So we've got our work cut out for us. It's important to see that all the theory in the world is not going to save the Americans from the very real consequences of their actions. The British, after all, didn't read the Declaration and say, well, they've got a good claim. They read it as a declaration of war. And the founders knew this. At the end of the Declaration, it reads, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortune, and our sacred honor. If the founders hadn't won, they would hang. As Benjamin Franklin quipped, we must all hang together, or assuredly, we will hang separately. But winning the war is just the first problem. Now that we're free of the English yoke, we have to set up a new government. Panic! How do we do this? We start with some Lockean principles. We know that all men are created equal, and that governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. Okay, that's a good starting point, but what does consent of the governed mean? According to a strict understanding of Lockean philosophy, every individual in the United States would have to say, I consent to the laws of the United States. Logistically, this is obviously very problematic, and even harder when you have the British knocking down your door. And this is where we see that the founders didn't rely exclusively on Lockean liberalism when they were setting things up. Whig theory comes back to play a role when they're trying to establish a stable and free government. For Whigs, people have to be connected to their government through a longer and older tradition. The founders tied these two theories together in order to create institutions that protect individual liberty without becoming so radically democratic that they threaten stability. They used these theories to tackle some of the most important questions of the day, such as how powerful should the federal government be? How do you distribute the executive, legislative, and judicial powers? How do you prosecute this war? How do you pay collectively for this war? This is the great experiment that they initiated when they declared independence. It is not one they took lightly. It required great sacrifice, great statesmanship, and a consensus among the people that their cause was just. For that reason, it's important to reflect on the significance of this action, both within the United States and around the world. We decided we were not going to submit to a heavy-handed government. We looked to philosophy to clarify our understanding of freedom and to understand how it is that we can build a new democratic constitutional order. Understanding the incredible character you have in order to embark on this task is very important. Understanding the incredible risks associated with revolution will help you see why it is they're so rare and so often unsuccessful. I hope you spend a little time thinking about how amazing it is that the founders declared that if people suffer under an oppressive rule, it is their right, their duty, to throw off that government. We should be alive to these concerns today, as we continue to think through what it means to live in a free society and what we expect from our government. And if it happens to be that you're watching this around the 4th of July, I hope you think through these issues while enjoying hamburgers and fireworks. Thank you very much.
You come to my door, and I'm white, you're black, and you say, sir, I want to buy your house. And I say to you, look, I won't sell my house to anyone who's black. Now, isn't that a negative outcome of a market?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that is, I mean, I could walk up to some white girl walk along the street and I say, well, look, lady, I want to marry you and you ought to give me equal opportunity. She said, well, look, I don't marry blacks. Or a white lady could come up to me and say, and ask me to marry her. I can say, look, I don't marry white ladies. Now, so what you're really talking about is freedom of choice. That is, I believe that you have the right to sell your house to whomever you please. I have the right to sell my house to whomever you please. Now, I don't believe you have the right to use the coercive powers of government to force your neighbor through law or through intimidation to sell his house to who you think he should sell his house to. Now, just looking at housing discrimination, for example, I think it's a very interesting example of the market. In the United States, there's been discrimination against blacks, but a lot of times you saw restrictive covenant laws, or you saw other kinds of intimidation, other intimidation against blacks from buying houses in certain areas, violent intimidation. Now, ask yourself, if white people would not sell their houses to blacks, why would you need a law? I mean, the very existence of a law suggests that there are people around that would not act according to the way the law specifies. So there's a real question of whether you, Bob Chittister, would sell the house, would refuse to sell the house to me. Economic theory says that there exists a price whereby you will sell the house to me. Now, maybe I don't want to go as high, I don't want to make the price that high, but there exists a price. Basic economics tells us that. And furthermore, I might add that if you look at cities like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, in the 1920s, before we even had an Equal Housing Act, whole neighborhoods were going from white to black virtually overnight, and nobody could stop it. That is, Harlem became a predominantly black neighborhood before there was any EEOC, before there was HUD, before there was any of these anti-discrimination laws. That is, the market took care of much of this problem. The market made discrimination very costly.
What limits, if any, would you set on the exercise of these private property rights, if you would?
Well, I would probably set very, very few limits. That is, and we really have to talk about, I'll just briefly mention what property rights are. Property rights are the right to keep, acquire, and dispose of property that's left in the hands of the owner of the property. Now, part of my property right, let's say if I own a house, means that you cannot run your car through my house because I own the house. Even though you own the car, it means that you cannot infringe upon my property rights. So, what I'm saying is that that as long as individuals do not infringe upon the property rights of others, I would say they have the right to use their property any way they want to.
Well, why is private property so important?
Well, private property is very, very, very important because it forces all of us to take into account our private or our current decisions on the future values of things. For example, I think that it is a good idea that houses be available for future generations. Let's say the kid that's going to be born in 2050 or 2075. It's probably a good idea that houses be around for him to live in. Now, the fact that I privately own my property forces me to take into account the effect of my current decisions on the life of my house. Now, the way that it forces me to do that is that if I don't make the necessary repairs to maintain my house, well, my house is going to deteriorate, and the selling price that I can get for my house is going to be very, very low. But if I take care of my house to ensure that it will provide housing services for many, many years, well, then the selling price of my house is going to be very, very high. Now, so through private property rights and the right to transfer without interference, it holds our personal wealth, as my colleague Armin Alshan says quite frequently, it holds our personal wealth hostage to our doing the right thing. Now, ask yourself, well, would people have the same kind of incentives to maintain their property or maintain a piece of property if the government owned the property? Or would they have the same kind of incentives to maintain property if there were a 75% tax on the property when you went to sell it? No, they wouldn't. And so what I'm saying in a nutshell is that private property forces people to do socially responsible things. And matter of fact, some of our greatest problems are in areas where things aren't held privately. That is, we hear all kinds of statements. People are worried about the extinction of the elephant. They're worried about the extinction of the whale. They have clubs, Ducks Unlimited, worrying about certain kinds of ducks. Now, I haven't heard a single person form a group worrying about the extinction of pigs and sheep and chickens and cows. Now, why not? Well, in the case of eagles and buffaloes, it is in no individual's personal private interest to spend a lot of resources making sure that buffaloes and eagles are well cared for. But however, it is in somebody's personal private interest to make sure that chickens and cows or sheep are taken care of properly or used wisely. So even in that area, we find that private property plays a great role. If you look around, ask yourselves, if you're driving along the highway and look at those shiny trucks. If you see a very shiny truck, very well taken care of truck, cared for truck, it's most likely that that truck is owner operated. And you see an old raggedy truck, it's one that where the driver is just an employer of the company. If you look at who takes care of a house, if you ask the question, who takes care of a house better, a renter or owner? Well, clearly, an owner has a vested stake in taking care of the property. A renter has a reduced set of incentives for taking care of the property. So private property plays a very, very important role in conserving on the scarce resources of our society.
Suppose someone left you an inheritance of $1 million with the proviso that every cent of it had to be spent on tickets for you to go watch professional wrestling matches. If you happened to be a professional wrestling fan, you would be in hog heaven. But what if you were not? How much would that $1 million be worth to you? certainly a lot less than $1 million. What if there was a clause in the will which said that you could forfeit $1 million and instead receive a cash amount of $100,000 to spend as you pleased? Many of us would take the $100,000 without strings, even if that was only 10 cents on the dollar compared to $1 million for watching wrestling. In short, money with strings is worth less than money without strings, sometimes a lot less. Many of us who receive money from Social Security or other government programs are learning the hard way the difference between money with strings and money without strings. For example, Social Security recipients have to be enrolled in Medicare, whether they want to be or not. Universal coverage means compulsory coverage, just with prettier political spin. Those who are complaining about how hard it is to understand the new Medicare coverage seem not to realize that no government program voted into law by more than 500 members of Congress is going to be simple. Everybody in Congress has his own pet notions or his own little claim to fame, and a lot of those pet notions and claims to fame have to go into the legislation in order to get the votes needed to pass the law. The complications and restrictions are the strings attached to Medicare. People who think that they are getting something for nothing by having government provide what they would otherwise have to buy in the private market are not only kidding themselves by ignoring the taxes that government has to take from them in order to give them the appearance of something for nothing, they are also ignoring the strings that are going to be attached to their own money when it comes back to them in government benefits. That is not even counting the fact that government programs are usually less efficient than similar services provided by private enterprises. Compare the service you get at the Department of Motor Vehicles with the service you get at AAA. No one who belongs to the American Automobile Association is likely to go to the DMV for a service that is also available through AAA. Yet the illusion of something for nothing has kept the welfare state going and expanding. If there is something for sale in the marketplace for $10 and you would not pay more than $5 for it, some politician can always offer to get it for you free, as a newly discovered basic right, or at least at a reasonable or affordable price. Suppose that the reasonable or affordable price is $3. How do you suppose the government can produce something for $3 that private industry cannot produce for less than $10? Greater efficiency in government? Give me a break. The fact that you pay only $3 at the cash register means nothing. If it costs the government $12 to produce and distribute what you are getting for $3, then the government is going to have to get another $9 in taxes to cover the difference. One way or another, you are going to end up paying $12 for something you are unwilling to buy for $10 or even $6. But so long as you think you are getting something for nothing, the politician's shell game has worked, and the welfare state can continue to expand. The illusion that Social Security can provide pensions more cheaply than a private annuity or other retirement plan is the grand something-for-nothing political triumph.